I'm Paul Stern. In my day job, I work at the National Research Council in Washington, D.C. in the United States, where I'm the director of the Committee on the Human Dimensions of Global Change, a standing interdisciplinary committee that does work on a variety of issues in human interactions with the environment. I also do some of my own research on the side, some of that on household environmentally significant behavior, and I will be talking about that. I see that you've got me up on your screen, and I hope that there's another screen with some slide presentations. Do we have that? I see it up there. My title, as you can see, is Environmentally Significant Behavior and How to Change It. It's an ambitious title, but we know something about that. And there's a lot, as you'll see, that you need to figure out for particular situations. Can we go to the next slide? I took a nice Sunday afternoon drive up through the land of our Seneca Aboriginal Nation, that's Seneca Lake. The colors are not as pretty on the screen as they are in reality. It's peak fall foliage this weekend. And I thought people might want to see it. Move on to the next slide, please. It's better for the earth than flying to Sydney. Anyway, in talking to the conference organizers in preparation for this meeting, I discovered, it seems, that the national policy context in Australia has some similarities to the American policy context in the sense that people have been waiting for the central government to take leadership on dealing with climate change by taking action to reduce the carbon footprints of our two countries, which are among the highest per capita in the world. And in both cases, the national governments have stalled. It's certainly the case over here. So that a lot of people who've been waiting for national policies to put a price on carbon through cap and trade or carbon taxes or something else like that to create incentives to reduce emissions, that hasn't happened at a national level. And, it's come to the point that people who want to do something have to ask the question, what do you do if the national government can't or won't take leadership? And there are some other things that you can do, but it involves working at the personal level, at the organizational level, at the community level, and in business, and also potentially getting the central government to move. Next slide. This is a conference about sustainability. Do you have the next slide? There we go. It's possible to get into endless arguments about definitions of sustainability, and I don't want to spend time doing that. My focus is on the environmental aspect. You've heard about the economic and social aspects of sustainability as well. I'm focusing on the environmental aspect and on the process of transition. I say transition because even though you can argue about what a sustainable society would look like, and we don't really know ultimately, we do know what direction to go in without knowing what the end point is. So the challenge is to get moving. And you've heard some stories about how Australia has been getting moving in some areas, although in the area of energy consumption, the US and Australia are, as far as I can tell, more or less in the same boat. Very high fossil fuel consumption per capita. So I'm going to talk about changing environmentally significant behavior. Next slide lists some different types of environmentally significant behavior. Environmental activism, and on the other side, it's environmentally significant to oppose environmental activism. So this is political kinds of behavior. short of activism, they support for opposition to sustainability goals and policies. That's environmentally significant behavior. And there's household consumer behavior, which is very important at the individual level. It involves the purchase, maintenance, and use of goods and services and of energy to produce the goods and services. In the United States, the household sector is responsible for between 35 and 40% of national energy use simply by direct consumption in homes and for non-business travel. So it's a large chunk. And consumer behavior is responsible for an additional, not quite so large chunk, indirectly through the purchase of goods and services that are not specifically energy. Then there's organizational behavior. And people can work on that through the organizations of which they are part. And there's community action, not just in physical communities that are places, but in professional communities, in other kinds of communities that are defined by things that people have in common. All of those kinds of environmentally significant behavior are potentially important. Next slide. So action can take place. Next slide. Okay, where you are, in your home, in your organization, in your motor vehicle or a non-motor vehicle, at the community level, and in influencing various units of government. In the United States, where the federal government has not been doing things, some state and local governments have been doing a lot more. So there are a lot of government units, and in Australia, I understand a similar situation exists. There are a lot of government units. Next slide. Why isn't there more sustainable behavior? I was alluding to cap and trade and carbon taxes and these sorts of policies that are based on the assumption that there isn't more sustainable behavior because the financial incentives are not right. And if you get the prices right, in the case of energy use, everything will follow. It's not as simple as that. We know from looking at what prices and financial incentives are in place now that there are a number of complications about getting the prices right. One is that price increases can be a blunt instrument. In the short term, especially, they can produce suffering instead of investment. If you live in a house that's leaky and it wastes energy, it costs money to fix it. And if you suddenly have a price increase, what will happen to most people is that their money will go into paying for energy rather than something else. And people with tight household budgets may not be able to make, in the short term, investments that would pay off for them in the longer term. And so you have that problem. So the other problem is that even when you have good financial incentives, and it's sort of related, you don't necessarily get the adoption of behaviors and equipment that will produce savings over the long term. The research shows that even if financial incentives are necessary, they're not sufficient. There's a persistent, what economists call an energy efficiency gap, which is the difference between the level of energy consumption that actually exists in a home or a vehicle or a community, an organization, and the amount of energy consumption that would exist if the decision makers put into place the behaviors and the technologies that at a reasonable rate of return would be most economically efficient. So at every level of incentive, there remains this energy efficiency gap. You find from experience that incentives are often less effective than expected, and the effects are very highly variable. Economists use the concept of price elasticity, and some people think that it's something like a natural constant, that energy has a price elasticity, and it has one in the short term, and it has a larger one in the long term. But experience shows that it doesn't have a fixed value, And my favorite example comes from back in the 1980s in the northwestern United States, when a number of different electric utility companies in the Columbia River Basin offered what they called an interim weatherization program. They provided grants to homeowners who, if they had their energy, if they had energy audits done in their home, the energy audit would recommend weatherization activities, some of them expensive. And the utility companies would provide what came out to an average of over 90% of the cost. And they did that because this was an area where people were heating with electricity or with wood. And if they continued to heat with electricity with population increasing, they would need to build power plants and they would need to switch from the hydroelectric power that they were using to some kind of fossil fuel that was way more expensive. So they thought it would be good for the utilities to invest in the houses. Seven different utilities offered this program, and if you look at the right-hand column of the next slide, I'm sorry, I didn't call for the slide, you will see a tremendous variation when it comes up in, and the numbers are the proportion of eligible households that had the weatherization done per year in a program that lasted a couple of years. And you see a variation between utility E that had 1.4% per year getting weatherized and utility D that had almost 20% per year getting weatherized with exactly the same incentive. If you look over, you know, that's a variation, a factor of 13.8 to 1. If you look over at the left-hand column, you can see that the reason for the variation is mainly getting the energy auditors into the home. Then once people had the energy audits, the majority of them in every case went ahead and had the work done. So it was an implementation problem that had not to do with the financial incentive, although the financial incentive convinced people once they had the energy audit to go ahead. But it wasn't enough. Next slide. We learned from looking at a number of incentive programs that were studied back in the 80s, the last time that they had a bunch of them in the U.S. They have some now again, but there haven't been a lot of studies come out yet. Is the slide coming up? Yes, it is. There it is. That non-financial factors explain a lot about why incentives have such weak and variable results. So money is a major influence on adopting energy-efficient equipment. When there were smaller incentives, there was a lot of variation due to whether people who had the energy audits went ahead and made the investment. Minimizing long-term cost is one motive that households have, but there are a lot of other motives that lead to different results. We find that cognitive effort is a major barrier to change. I'll come back to that. And that inertia is also a barrier to change. Habits, routines, standard operating procedures in organizations are also important. So reducing non-financial barriers to change has great potential, even with the current financial incentives, and with stronger financial incentives, maybe even greater potential. Next slide. I'm talking now about a general strategy for increasing sustainable behavior, whatever the incentive structure is. Is it coming up? I can't see it very well from here. I can see the big screen. General strategy is, first, you need to identify some target behaviors and target actors. Second, identify the barriers to change, especially the ones that you can influence. Then address the barriers, and also, and it's not fourth, but it's another part of the strategy, is to engage the community. Next slide. To identify high impact target behaviors, I sometimes use an equation. It says here I equals TPN. I is the environmental impact. In the case of energy use, carbon emissions is a good proxy for environmental impact. T is the technical potential. If everybody who could do something did it, how much difference would it make? P is the behavioral plasticity. what proportion of those people could you get to change their behavior? And N is the number of people who are in a position to act. So this is sort of an accounting equation, but it says you need to pay attention to these three variables if you're looking for high impact behaviors. Next slide. You can't pick the target behaviors without doing some careful analysis. People are often mistaken in their homes about which behaviors have the greatest impact, and there's a systematic bias here. People are more likely to overemphasize visible, frequent behaviors like turning off the lights when you leave the room, turning off the television set when you leave the room, and to underestimate behaviors that are infrequent and behaviors that involve the choice of equipment. One of the biggest things to influence household energy consumption is which home you live in. A lot of things follow from that. Which vehicle you own to travel with, which appliances you have, what the temperature setting is on your water heater, so forth. Things that are done infrequently but have a large impact. People don't notice. So there is a need for short lists of high-impact actions. You can do it for households. You can do it for a business. You can do it for a university. And it's important to develop one for the target actors that you're trying, whose behaviors you're trying to change. So one bottom line is to research the potential behavioral targets. Next slide. You can't see this one very well. It doesn't matter too much. My colleague Jerry Gardner and I published a paper a couple of years ago trying to come up with a short list of household activities for an average U.S. household, looking at things in the home and looking at things in personal transportation, and trying to identify for an average home what percentage reduction in your household energy budget you could get by doing A, B, C, D, E. We looked at a few dozen things and tried to come up with a short list. Now, that's very generic. In the United States, in homes, a lot depends on whether you live in a cold climate or a hot climate. You know, a lot depends on whether you live in a tightly compact city or in a suburb, which things you're able to do. The notion here was to make up a list, and then the household could look at the list and say, which of these are possible for me, and prioritize that way. This is another piece. Next slide is another piece of the short list paper. And the general idea is that people need these. We'll go on to the next slide down that says identifying non-financial barriers to change, looking at household behaviors. There's been a lot more research on household behaviors than there has been on organizational behavior. But I'm going to try to talk about both of these because I understand that there are a fair number of people at the conference who come from businesses that are interested in organizational behavior in their businesses. Maybe some will come from universities who are thinking about those organizations. In the household, there's a list of five. They have subcategories under them, and I put asterisks next to a couple that are important and underappreciated. Motivation and beliefs, values, intentions, and so forth are important, but not easy to change quickly. External context is important, sometimes not easy to change, but sometimes underappreciated. And you need to consider the external context for people's behavior because it influences what they can do, how difficult it is to do it, and so forth. Personal capabilities and constraints, knowledge, time, attention are important. They can be easy or difficult to change. Cognitive effort, which I will continue to talk about, is very important, often neglected, and habit and routine. Cognitive effort, in the example of household energy efficiency, I'll take a personal example from the last few days. I live in a single-family detached house that needs a new roof. There are financial incentives that our federal government puts out for energy-efficient roofing materials. I tried to find out you know, what kinds of roofing materials would I actually have to get in order to get the 30% financial incentive? I went online. I called the U.S. Department of Energy. I eventually determined that there's a list of, there's a 160-page list of roofing products that qualify for the Energy Star label, but not all of them get the financial incentive. There is no list of which ones get the financial incentive. You have to ask them, you have to get a certificate from the manufacturer. There's a tremendous amount of cognitive effort in order to collect this incentive, and most people are not going to do it. Next slide. For organizational behavior, there's a parallel set of non-financial barriers. Some of them easier to change, some of them not. There's leadership. I mean, the stories from companies say, you know, how did this company decide to become green? Well, the leader had an epiphany. You know, the CEO had an epiphany and the word came down from the top. And that seems to happen sometimes. That's hard to change unless you're the CEO. There's the issue of the definition of your mission. There have been some surveys done in the United States of companies, and they find that energy efficiency is just not considered one of the core activities of the company. We're in the business of making steel products. We're in the business of selling travel packages. Whatever we do, you know, energy efficiency is not one of the things that we pay attention to. It's not a core activity. It doesn't get priority. That can change. External context exists for organizations just as it does for individuals, but it's different. There are regulatory constraints. There are standard operating procedures, sort of the industry, expectations of what this kind of a company pays attention to. There are physical problems, just as households have them. There are capabilities. You know, is there the know-how in a company that's not in the business of energy efficiency? Is there somebody who knows how to do it? Is there somebody who has the responsibility to do it? There are the costs of information and transactions, and then there are standard operating procedures. There are accounting systems. Is anybody keeping track of energy use in the company? And then there's the matter of hurdle rates. In the U.S. surveys, they find that they ask energy officers or, you know, chief operating officers in companies, if you were going to make an investment in energy efficiency, how quickly would it have to pay back before you'd be willing to make it? You know, what percent annual return on investment do you expect? And you find that they set higher hurdle rates for investments in energy efficiency than they do for investments in product development. You know, they want 30 or 40% per year back, more or less like a household. You can't get that return on any other kind of investment. Why do you want it for energy efficiency? Well, they do. And maybe that can be changed. Next slide. Which factors are most important among the barriers to behavioral change? It's not usually one factor alone. The most important influences are not the same for all behaviors and not the same for all households or for all organizations. Finding the most important ones requires some research or some conversation. The strongest influences are often contextual. They're outside the individual, outside the organization. And the most effective interventions are based on understanding the full range of causes and barriers to change. So the bottom line is you need to do some research. It can be fancy research. It can be not so fancy research. It can be going around talking to people and asking them why they don't do X, Y, or Z. Next slide. With households, a general strategy for interventions has a few points to it. First of all, understand the behavior from the household's perspective, which means asking or looking around or putting yourself in their place. Recognize that household behavior is often constrained by factors beyond the household's control. A pep talk isn't going to do it. Address multiple barriers to behavioral change, as I said. Tailor the intervention to the target action. What's the problem with this particular behavior you want to change? Use a combination of influence techniques, information, marketing, financial incentives, and so forth. and because we don't know everything that could be known about changing behavior, monitor the effects of your efforts continually. Next slide is a list of design principles for effective household targeted programs, and that comes from a paper that several of us published in Environmental Science and Technology earlier this year, based on a reading of the literature. What's up on the screen that I see is a mix of two slides. But the list of design principles, in case you have trouble seeing it, is to first prioritize high-impact actions, then provide sufficient financial incentives, strongly market the program, provide valid information from credible sources at the points of decision, keep it simple, few hurdles to jump. That's been a problem in a lot of programs in the U.S. You need to get an energy audit. You need to collect incentives from federal, state, local governments, and utility companies with different kinds of paperwork in each case. You need to keep records. You need to file tax forms. And finally, provide quality assurance. Some of the effort in retrofitting a house is finding a contractor who can do it well without a timely manner, without disrupting the home, and so forth, and will do it well. So this is a non-financial barrier that can be highly significant. The next slide looks at organizations. And I think I won't have time to go into this much, but it's not based on as much research. But it's a parallel set of barriers that you need to address. And I have put in boldface one of them: look for organizational factors. Because if you're in an organization, you may be able to do something about standard procedures, accounting rules, split responsibilities. One part of the organization is responsible for energy. Another part of the organization is responsible for investments. The energy managers are just the maintenance guys. They don't have a budget for equipment, maybe. And you need to look at one part of the organization having one responsibility and another part, you know, unable to do what it needs to do. Again, look at multiple barriers, tailor the intervention, combine influence techniques, and monitor. Next slide.
Paul?
Yes.
Yeah, I just let you know, you got probably about 5 minutes left, yeah?
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I think I can manage that. A guess at some design principles for organizational change, and they are similar, except for the third one, identify new routines and accounting systems. But it's, you know, if you take the same attitude toward figuring out the problems and the barriers in an organization, I think it can go a long way. You have to do some research on the organization. Next slide is my favorite. There is Kermit the Frog, reminding us it's not easy being green. It's not enough to want to do it. Policy facilitation is critical to overcome cognitive burdens. Now, policy can come from government. It can come from higher levels of an organization. And facilitation can sometimes come from other kinds of organizations. How do you reduce cognitive burdens? How do you provide for quality assurance? How do you develop trustworthy information? The central government is not necessarily very good at that. You know, it needs to be somebody who's closer to the target actors. It could be a community organization. It could be a trade association. It could be a utility company. It could be an environmental group. It could be a private sector company that's taken on the job of reducing the cognitive burden in the United States, where you have incentives from a lot of different places, and it's a lot of work to figure out which ones apply to you. You know, where you have contractors who all want to sell you their product, and you don't know how well it's going to save energy for you. There is a niche to fill for somebody to reduce the cognitive burden on the decision makers. Next slide. So there are opportunities for a lot of people who I think are the kind of people at your conference to develop short lists for target groups or organizations. What are the best things that they can do people don't know about themselves? To get credible information sources to offer information. There's always somebody trying to sell you something who's willing to offer information. But who can you trust? And it's useful to try to figure that out for a target behavior. Who can they trust? And how can you get them to offer information that's useful at the point of decision? Provide services to offer validate tailored information designed for that user. Reduce the burden of quality assurance. Create new standard operating procedures, accounting systems and organizations, valid carbon calculators for households, and so forth. And finally, engaging communities is very important. It's not necessarily academic research that you need that can be helpful, but sometimes dialogue can be very helpful to develop short lists for a community, for an organization. There are some people in a community or an organization who are experts in the kind of sustainable behavior that you're interested in, and other people who are not. You put them together, you can get credible information to people from people they trust. Dialogues to identify barriers within a community or an organization can generate pressure to reduce them. It can provide information. Dialogues across communities, dialogues among different units in an organization, organizations in an industry, departments in a university, localities in a region, can start to identify common barriers and think about what to do to change them. And then dialogues about fundamental change. We have a fundamental change here. It would have been nice to go to Australia, but I'm talking to you, and shortly you'll be talking to me over a video link. And there are other sources of other types of fundamental change. I can't finish without mentioning, I've been talking about direct energy use a lot. Next slide. There are a lot of other important targets for sustainable behavioral change. Indirect energy use for households, food, non-energy goods and services, for companies and other organizations, the goods and services that they purchase, and the footprints on the earth embodied in those. Infrastructure is an important target for behavioral change. I'm glad to hear that they're doing a lot about bicycle access in Sydney. Alternatives to motor vehicles, is an important infrastructural change. The design of low-energy buildings and communities is an important infrastructural change. Makes it much easier for people to have lower impact in their daily behavior if their infrastructure facilitates that. User-friendly accounting systems, carbon footprints, carbon calculators, energy cost of occupancy, numbers for homes and other buildings, and so forth. And then getting to the end of my time and the end of the slide, we go to the drivers of consumption and lifestyle. And next, almost to the end of this, changing lifestyles is a big deal. It's not easy to do. It doesn't happen overnight. But changing behaviors one by one, which is mostly what I've been talking about, may not be enough to get where you want to go for sustainability. Lifestyles are patterns of behavior, patterns of travel, patterns of eating, accumulation of possessions that have, in the U.S. and I think Australia, become much more energy and carbon and environmentally intensive over the last 100 years, 50 years. Maybe it's changing in some respects in the last 20 or 30 years. This kind of change isn't easy. It needs support. It needs infrastructural change, as the previous speaker was noting. There are issues of labor in the U.S. anyway. Labor-saving devices that use energy have become more necessary in people's lives as they see it. Nobody's got time to cook. You do things fast. You substitute energy for time. Changing that is not easy. And so changing lifestyles is, for most people, it's more than just a matter of wanting to be green. Social norms, as have been mentioned and will be mentioned a lot in the conference, I'm sure, are important. They can change over a generational timescale. Sometimes they need infrastructure to make them possible. Recycling is a good example. You can change the norms for recycling only when it's easy enough to recycle. And information I've already mentioned. Next slide. How do we get support for changing lifestyles? It generally happens in communities, towns, workplaces, universities, professional groups. It involves changing norms. It involves supportive policies. And community conversations, national conversations may even be possible. I don't know what the situation in Australia is for national conversations about becoming more sustainable, but I hope that that's possible. And I've come to the end. I hope this will stimulate further discussion, it says in the next slide. And then the one beyond that is the very last, which is available to people, has a few references and contact information for me.